Hi, from Mystical, Washington, this is Deepak Singh.
I'm from Cambridge, Massachusetts, this is Hari Jayaram.
And you're listening to The Coast.
The Coast.
Bio.
Podcast.
Hey, Hari, how are you?
Oh, great, real great.
I must apologize for my lack of, for my disappearing act last week. We were supposed to record a podcast, but thanks to the wonderful internet connections at in my hotel room at in Austin, that just didn't materialize. So we missed a week, but hopefully we'll correct that this time around.
Right. And I was basically almost jet lagged after my 4-day marathon session at the Chicago Synchrotron this time.
Okay.
And consequently, things just didn't work out right when we made a brief attempt at recording the podcast last week.
Yeah, so how did things go at the Synchrotron?
Great. Well, this time we got only 2 terabytes of data. So let's see how things go. We're still processing a lot of it and trying to figure out what exactly is going on.
Yeah, understandable. But otherwise, mostly successful trip? Or
absolutely.
Do you think you'll end up going again soon?
Well, no trips for 2 months or so. So, you know, kind of like Christmas break and so on. So
yeah.
early next year, we should be back there.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, I was at Supercomputing and it was definitely an interesting trip. Of course, before that, the Friday before that, I was at Virginia Tech, where I gave a talk thanks to Chris Lasher's invitation. The video is out there now, so if you really want to pain yourself, you can go watch it. It's an early cut. There's a quick and dirty pre-Thanksgiving cut. Apparently, there'll be a higher res cut after he gets back from the Thanksgiving vacation. But supercomputing was great. It was very interesting. It's the first time I've actually gone to a supercomputing meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's enough hardware porn to ogle at. And
I saw your brief tweet about ogling, and I guess there was a word that should have been there, but really wasn't there.
Yeah,
you were like, I was ogling at supercomputers, just for the record.
Yeah. Although on Sun's booth, this is the first conference I've been in a long time where they had lots of booth babes. Sun Microsystems being one of the more egregious, whatever you want to call them. What's the word for it? It's escaping my mind anyway. Egregious culprits. But it was definitely an interesting meeting, and lots of big machines, lots of stuff on the cloud, lots of fast storage, lots of data centers. NVIDIA was very prominent. They have their teraflop GPU out now, the Tesla.
Mm-hmm.
I actually entered a couple of draws to try and win a personal supercomputer. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. It didn't quite work out. So these are these teraflop multiple teraflop machines with 4 GPU cards in them. Interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm. And how big a conference was it? Was it like?
They said there were 11,000 or 12,000 people. It was interesting though. I found that there were more in terms of vendor versus attendee ratios. It was more vendor heavy than most conferences I've been at.
Mm-hmm.
To some extent, that's not surprising with all the big iron over there and lots of universities and research centers. But I think the talk section actually was not that great, and Michael Dell gave like the worst keynote I've ever seen anybody give. I'm never getting a job at Dell after this. But it was just an advertisement for Dell, nothing of substance, by and large. So it was very disappointing.
Oh, I have a very naive question actually about supercomputing in general. So, mm-hmm. Am I right in assuming that when it comes to the world of supercomputing / high performance computing, in terms of like the actual operating system, that, you know, obviously it's all about hardware architectures and so on, but if you were to talk about actual operating systems, is there pretty much like a Unix, Solaris kind of Linux kind of bias? Or
no,
do you actually
historically there used to be custom, you know, various flavors of Unix. So SGI had their own flavor of Unix,
right.
IBM would have their own.
Uh-huh.
You know, the AIX systems, Sun would have their Solaris systems, HP would have their HP UX systems.
Right.
But now in the big supercomputer list, there's so many commodity systems or even non-commodity systems, but with running Linux.
Mm-hmm.
So, I would guess if you just counted, Linux would be the most dominant, but things like, you know, BlueJean, I don't know what Roadrunner runs. That's that new beast that IBM built out of cell processors and regular commodity processors. It's a petaflop machine. I don't know what OS that's running. My guess would be AIX. But, you know, there's a lot of commodity hardware out there, and those machines are really fast, and they all run Linux. Microsoft was also there, and they had their compute cluster server, HPC operating versions of their operating systems in, you know, being displayed. I don't know too many people who are using them. There's definitely a few, especially maybe on the visualization type of side. But, you know, definitely StarNext systems are by far dominant.
I see. And in terms of, you were there by Amazon, correct?
Yeah, yeah, I was there. Basically, we didn't have a booth or anything. I was there attending talks, meeting people.
I see.
You know, yeah, so, you know, there's a bunch of booths showing EC2, for example, the Mathematica people, the MATLAB people, so on and so forth.
Actually,
so,
yeah, speaking of Mathematica, last week on Tuesday, I did go attend a webinar on Mathematica 7. And okay. Have you ever checked out Mathematica in the last 2 years?
No, the last time I actually played with Mathematica was 6 years ago.
Oh, so okay, here is an uninvited plug for Mathematica. So around a year back, I actually did attend Mathematica 6 introduction talk, and now they have Mathematica 7. But basically, Mathematica 6, they've rewritten the whole kind of engine inside out, and it's amazing. For example, the guy who gave us the talk was from Mathematica, from Wolfram Labs, and the entire talk was given from inside Mathematica.
So yeah, they heard about a full
through and through layer, which basically, I mean, you can have a full live document which has multimedia embedded into it, and everything is inside Mathematica. So he was actually demoing, downloading full structures from the PDB, you know, querying web front ends, you know, like web services, getting sequences in, processing them, plotting them live. And once it was done, he could just package it as a, you know, a MATLAB notebook and send it out to, you know, your collaborator.
You mean a Mathematica notebook?
Yeah. Did I say MATLAB? Yeah. Sorry. Oops. Yeah, but it was very, very impressive. And in fact, I would say they have quite a few of their web seminars on their website. If anybody hasn't looked at Mathematica in the last 2 years, or let me put it this way, if you haven't looked at Mathematica 6 and Mathematica 7, do yourself a favor and look at it, because it is an amazing, amazing platform.
I'll have to check it out. Unfortunately, I think the licenses are too expensive for poor old individual me.
That's true, exactly. I'm fortunate that Brandeis is actually a Wolfram or Mathematica campus, so I get my free staff license.
Yeah. It's very impressive. My advisor was in graduate school, was a Mathematica person, so that's pretty much how I did a lot of my work, algorithmic work at that time. So I'm sure it's changed completely since then, but I always had a very soft spot for Mathematica. I've actually used MATLAB since then. Not too much, but I have.
Yeah, I've used MATLAB more than I have used Mathematica, but especially after looking at 6, it's very convenient to quickly learn what small functions are doing. And also, they have this concept called a data store. So they have data stores built, you know, out of web services, as well as custom data stores. So you can bring in like population data from like, you know, you can bring in small molecule data. You can bring in so much data and compute with it inside it. It is definitely a great product.
I should definitely check it out at least, just for old time's sake, if nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have, actually, I just got cut off, so I'm going to start again. So we have quite the lineup today, mostly around a bunch of stories that I did. We put up on Delicious, and the first thing I actually wanted to talk about comes out of supercomputing. And that was a talk that I saw from somebody at D.E. Shaw. And, you know, are you aware of what D.E. Shaw research is?
No, I just looked at his website, and it seemed like, you know, a name that I should recognize.
So D.E. Shaw I don't think he actively runs it now, used to run a big hedge fund, one of the better known hedge funds out there. Funny story is Jeff Bezos used to work at D.E. Shaw before he started Amazon. So D.E. Shaw is obviously a very, very rich guy. He also happens to be a scientist. So I remember a few years ago being very jealous because Schrodinger, which was a competitor of ours when I was at Accelerus, was this company that had a lot of the funding came from D.E. Shaw. And he has his own research arm as well that looks at sort of more futuristic stuff. And what we found was that on the Schrodinger's, what I found was D.E. Shaw was publishing single author papers on things like how to re-implement a new implementation of the particle mesh evolved some method for doing molecular dynamics simulation. He's the only author on it. Hardcore theory paper. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And your response to that often is, so how are you supposed to compete with a company where their sort of funding guy writes single author hardcore theoretical papers for fun? D-Shaw is his sort of research arm. I know they've been spending a lot of time trying to build a special purpose supercomputer for doing MD simulations. I have my own opinions on that. I don't know if that's something you necessarily want to do. But the talk at supercomputing was essentially on the fact that, okay, you have this special purpose supercomputer, which is designed for one thing, to do MD simulations better. But what about the trajectories that you're trying to analyze? And these are like millisecond length trajectories, millisecond time scale. So they're really long, wow, really complex trajectories. And you want to do...
Okay, just for the MD newbie, I guess on a normal kind of lab grade cluster, you can probably get to...
Well, by the time I finished grad school, like a decade ago, you were talking about, you know, nanosecond is about the longest you used to get. Now, these are state of the art. Exactly. I mean, people have done microsecond simulations now, but hundreds of nanoseconds is more typical. Still, I mean, it takes a long time to do those simulations, and so these you have these near millisecond scale trajectories, and to analyze them, they decided to go a different way instead of the traditional ways. I mean, I've always used CHARMS internal analysis tools or something from an AMD to do the analysis. And here what they did was they combined MapReduce and VMD. They actually did their own MapReduce implementation to do all these, to do this trajectory analysis. And essentially use that to, you know, analyze the trajectories at scale, because essentially MapReduce is a data intensive task. And here you have data which you want to analyze and process. They extended it to do some things that you cannot do with traditional MapReduce. And then the way they implemented it was so that it would work very well with VMD, which, you know, so many people use to analyze it, you know, visualize the trajectories and so on. And I thought that was pretty neat. The room was packed. It was a good talk. The method is called HiMark. And they basically, the way they've developed it, they said can be generalized to other kinds of simulations as well, not just molecular dynamics.
So this, I guess the assumption then is that if they've mapped the MapReduce paradigm onto MD, right? That's what they've basically done. So then you can start running these on these big, you know, like things like EC2 and so on, or Google App, well, I don't know, like the big clusters out there.
MapReduce is a system for commodity clusters. Which, in other words, if you have access to lots of commodity hardware, it's a method that can be distributed easily across those commodity systems. So, for example, Hadoop essentially consists of two parts, a job scheduler and a distributed file system. So what it does is basically it distributes data across nodes, across a large number of nodes, creates this distributed file system across those nodes. Then you have two things you have to write. You have to write a mapper, which basically spreads the jobs out, and, you know, the framework will take care of the parallelization. You only have to worry about the function that you're writing. And then you have to write a reduce function, which gets everything together.
I see.
So that's very high level. That's how MapReduce works. They have sort of, HiMark people have sort of a chained approach where you can sort of launch another MapReduce job from a MapReduce job, because you want to sort of go into these trajectories in a more hierarchical manner and go that way. So.
Wow. That's impressive. So I guess it's reasonable to expect that very soon, you know, millisecond.
I don't know. I mean, obviously they're building an expensive special purpose computer for this. But on the other hand, even large, many hundreds of nanoseconds, you can do, you know, complex trajectories.
Okay, I see.
You know, it'll be interesting to see how it's a new way of doing trajectory analysis and more efficient. The speed ups were tremendous. So it's the kind of thing that you're really excited about. And I think by integrating it into VMD, they did a really smart job.
I see, right. No, I've used VMD for some of the visualization, just in crystallography. But I must say, I know almost nothing about MapReduce. I've kind of looked at the paper. It's on Google's site and so on.
Well, but, Google just is one, did this one petabyte sort on any on X thousand number of nodes. Sort of, I think it's a new record for doing a sort using MapReduce.
Wow.
They, of course, have their own implementation, which is very secret in terms of they publish the method, but their framework and implementation is definitely proprietary to them.
Wow.
So that's the secret sauce, as many people call it.
And the two big kind of parallelization systems out there is Hadoop and MapReduce. Is that
no, Hadoop correct? Is just an open source implementation of MapReduce that's that's been heavily funded by Yahoo.
But
it's an Apache project. There's other implementations of MapReduce. HiMark is one. Other people have, you know, various people have done it themselves because it's a published algorithm.
I see. Right.
So yeah, absolutely.
So and so this HiMark thing has a significant hardware angle component to it?
No, exactly. It doesn't, right? It can be run on commodity clusters. That's the whole point of Hadoop and MapReduce and all these things, is that you don't need fancy hardware to do that, unlike the simulation itself, which is being done on specialized hardware.
I see.
Okay. Yeah.
Because, and that's, that hardware is being developed by Schrodinger.com? Or?
No, by D.E. Shaw.
By D.E. Shaw?
It's called Anton.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's a specialized purpose-built computer, as they say. Mm-hmm. It's been built for a purpose. And, I mean, come to think of it, that was what BlueJean was supposed to be originally. It seems to have gone away from that over the years. But, it was definitely one of the more fun talks I saw. MD was there. VMD was ubiquitous at the conference. I think about a third of the booths were showing their visualization tools. Visualization, sort of high performance visualization stuff using VMD as their sort of visualization application. Definitely it was all over the place. So yeah, that was it. A couple of other things that I sort of wanted to talk about from supercomputing. There's John Buto, I think that's his name, or Peter Buto, Buto from National Cancer Institute gave a talk on CABIG. CABIG is this cancer bioinformatics grid that the National Cancer Institute has developed. It's got a bunch of things in it for service discovery, security, and so on. My biggest problem with that is that while conceptually it's great and the idea behind it is fabulous, I think they've over-engineered it, like so many things that people tend to do. And it looks like a very heavy architecture, and there's too many things that they've sort of built themselves, and there's good open web standard type things around. What he did was he mentioned a couple of things in his talk that were pretty interesting. One was this thing called the Cancer Molecular Analysis Portal. The links will be there in the show notes, which sort of is this, I think if you sign up for it, you get a set of tools and visualization stuff that allows you to visualize a lot of known cancer data, which they've been collecting from all their centers that are part of CABIG, the NCI centers. So that definitely looks interesting. You know, it's got visualization for, you know, stuff for visualizing genes, visualizing markers, so on and so forth. Did you get a chance to sort of quickly glance through that?
Yeah, I was looking at their the genome, the analysis portal. It's pretty impressive, actually. And all of this is from the NCI, right? And didn't the first cancer genome just come out? I mean, it was like last couple of weeks back.
Yeah, I heard about it on, I heard the thing on Nature podcast. I think that's where I, exactly. I mean, what's the cancer genome was an interesting question that I first asked, you know. No, cancer is not cancer is not a species, I guess.
That's true. No, to slightly go off topic, I was talking to one of my friends who works in stem cell biology, and she was saying how after this publication of this paper, a lot of naysayers of cancer genomics have really, really started to take their words back, saying that they had no idea as to how complicated, they didn't expect the cancer genome to be as information rich as it's turning out to be. And I guess, building a portal like this is very timely, I guess, if cancer genomics is going to get really take hold in the, at least in the research community. I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, I actually have an interesting problem at my end that if I move my focus away from my recording window, I think I didn't set release background when I was doing this, my recording stops. So putting things together is going to be interesting. Uh-oh. Because I've moved away. I haven't lost anything.
Oh my goodness. Well, we could.
It's just going to allow make me move some things around here and there. Luckily, where I stopped recording, there's a gap because it keeps playing. It just stops recording, so my cursor keeps going. So that's a good thing because if the cursor stopped, then I would really have to cut and piece up. But what it means is that I can't look at the stories. Right. No, that's okay. I have most of them in my head, so you'll have to help me out in a few cases. The other thing that he sort of talked about, which was interesting, is this big, what was it called? The Big Health Consortium, which consists of everybody from like the 23andMe's and the Navigenics of the world. It's sort of a big personalized medicine coalition. It's one of those things that you want, you watch with interest, but you're always skeptical about. Is it really going to work? All the right people are involved, but in my experience, organizations like this usually don't achieve too much.
Right, and it seems like there's so many new and young players in this that, well, it's good that they're kind of...
It definitely legitimizes them. Right? You know, if they're part of things like this big health consortium, which consists of pharma, government, and also the 23andMe's and the Navigenics of the world, it's an interesting... You know, they have a seat at the table, which is saying something.
Right, right. And I don't know, somehow I think this is also, I don't know, the cynic in me thinks it could be an attempt by all of them to get together to kind of build up a coalition in advance for the onslaught that they're going to be facing in the public. And it seems like there's a brewing kind of battle out there against personal genomics in some way, especially coming from, and I think this smacks of, I don't know. It might be that they're just trying to kind of band together to make their case because in a way they're all fighting the same battles.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's in it together, whether it's the NCI or the pharma companies, which are definitely want to work with 23andMe and Navigenics and get access to a lot of that information, that phenotypic information that they have to get real meaningful. You know, they don't have access to this much data. This is like a treasure trove of data that pharma companies could use. In just to sort of run, you know, one way to do it is, let's say you come up with a model inside your labs of some drug, a genetic model for some drug. How do you sort of test it in an unbiased population? You could essentially almost, one way I think about it is that you could use basically take everybody that 23andMe has worked with, all the genotypes, all the phenotypes, create this completely anonymized database, and essentially run a screen against it without any knowledge of what the, you know, obviously statistically you'll have to clear some things up because that's a, you know, mostly white Caucasian or whatever that database is. But let's say you could do that and you had some of that information in there. You could sort of run your classifiers or something against that data set to see if they actually work in a sort of a general population. Because it is like a general population. There's no, you're not selected in any particular way.
Right. Well, you're selecting for people who can pay, what's it, $2,300 to...
No. It's actually, that's like $400, $500
bucks. Okay, that's cheap.
Yeah, it's cheap enough that I'm thinking about.
I don't know. We'll see.
Just for the heck of it. And, you know, you have things like Snipedia, which are like the Mike Cariassos thing, which you can compare against 23andMe. And, you know, it's entirely possible that, you know, because they use a Illumina chip with like some custom markers on it and so on and so forth. So it'll be interesting to see how this whole thing, partnership stuff works. Now, historically, I think most of these are there for name only or as a lobby group.
But
as you are alluding to the fact that it's more of a lobby group, and I don't disagree with that.
The thing that got me thinking about that was, you know, you pick up any issue of Science or Nature, and there's at least, you know, four or five letters, or there's, you know, at least a few articles which are talking about what Decode's in trouble, their test, you know, a lot of people are questioning their test for breast cancer.
Decode's in trouble not because of their genetic testing stuff. G-Code Genetics, the company, the parent company, is in trouble because they're in Iceland and Iceland's economy is...
That's obviously going to be really bad for them. But, I mean, I was reading this thing about their tests, right, which is using like 10 or 15 markers for breast cancer. And you know, a lot of even physicians are questioning the validity of those tests. And, you know, they are pioneers in that sense, but you just see all these small battles being fought in, you know, different.
Yeah, but I also think it's a lot of turf protection. Obviously, anybody with any knowledge of genetics knows that the what you're getting out of a 23andMe test, for example, in terms of what it's telling you when it comes to disease is very limited.
Exactly. Uh-huh.
But it's a knowledge base that will grow. It gets people, from my perspective, it gets people interested in their genetics. With the right education, I mean, I see it as an opportunity. It has to be, you have to do it carefully. Right now, it's still expensive enough that the people who are doing it are the kinds of probably educated, probably have some sense to go through some of these things. The danger happens when it gets more, you know, even more mainstream. But, you know, I think the potential rewards, both in terms of education and long-term as our knowledge increases, is well worth the sort of short-term risks. And the genie's out of the bottle. You can't do anything about it now. You might as well embrace it. And I think physicians would do well to get a better understanding of genetics because most of them don't.
I agree with what you're saying, but I really think that the genie's out of the bottle a little too early in the sense that, you know, I mean, you're going to have this initial fad of people getting, you know, their genomic information, but it's going to there's going to be so little value for the immediate next few years from that information that I think it'll kind of quieten down. But of course, it's not going away. I agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I mean, the value is very limited, but it's you know, right now it's still a toy primarily. Right. But nobody's making, by and large, as far as I know, maybe one or two people do, nobody's making health decisions because of it. I mean, you can't go and get a prescription based on what this is saying. You have to talk to a doctor.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, if you start taking care of your health because you have a, you know, 10% extra, you know, 1.2% extra chance of getting something, and you stop eating fat and start exercising, maybe it's a good thing. yeah, but I see your point too. I mean, definitely, they have, all these companies are treading a very fine line, and they have to be careful.
Right.
So, anyway, so what was our next story?
Well,
since I can't look at the list.
Oh, you can't? Okay, well, we had the one about the Galaxy Zoo.
Oh, yeah. That was very fascinating. That's data from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, isn't
right,
it?
Right. And it was kind of like the recaptures and so on. It was a very cool attempt at getting humans to classify galaxies. So this started, 2 years back or so? The basic idea of the site was that human beings can obviously recognize patterns better than anybody else. And you go into the website and you train yourself to identify, you know, to basically classify galaxies like a spiral galaxy and so on and so forth. And once you kind of train yourself, you take a small test. And once you're certified that you can recognize a spiral galaxy from any other kind of galaxy, then you, every once in a while when you're, have some cycles to spare, you could go onto the site and start classifying galaxies. Now it turns out...
Oh, wonderful. So, wonderful.
So, yeah, it turns out that they finally got, I forget the exact number, but tens of thousands of these classified now and have gone through the analysis. And, of course, they repeated with expert software, but now they have their papers out and they've actually harnessed, you know, the collaborative frameworks of the web to do real science. And it's very exciting, I think.
Yeah, this is kind of stuff like this, that Google flu trend stuff. I mean, this is how it should be, in my opinion, right? I mean, it's really... I mean, I think this is the kind of stuff that, let's say if I knew about it, which I didn't, I would definitely go and try and do this because it's exciting. If you have kids, you can train them to, you know, I'm sure you can get kids interested in doing like this. It's not boring, it's interesting. It gets you excited and, you know, especially if you get some interesting software along with it, that allows you to sort, if they've designed the software well, it gets people really interested. I think we should have more and more and more of such, you know, all these projects. You know, one of the things I've really been thinking about lately, if I have the time sometime in the near future, I'd really like to get involved in sort of science outreach amongst smart kids. Yeah. You know, I think there's a lot of smart kids who are not getting, you know, people are interested. When I say smart, I mean people who have a natural inclination to try and learn, but don't necessarily have the right avenues, or they're stuck with their book, you know, traditional school curriculum. Mm-hmm. Sort of, what are the avenues that you can explore with people like that? I'm really interested in figuring things like that out. And things like this Galaxy Zoo, I think, fit very well into that category.
Right. Actually, speaking of outreach, I must thank Chris Lasher. He put up a link on the /C2C bio on somebody in the UK who actually spent, I guess, a whole day in a school talking to kids about science. And he had this very nice post about, you know, what all he did, the questions he got, the slides he kind of used, what worked, what didn't work. It was very, very useful because on Saturday morning, I was also headed to a school down in Western Mass. And thanks to that post, I tailored my entire slides based on what he said worked. Like, you know, I mean, simple rules like no words, just use images through and through. Make things as exciting. Do not exactly tell them what you do, but kind of give them the broader picture. And I had like 2 10-minute talks, and it worked very, very well. And so thanks a lot, Chris.
I think I need to do that. I mean, after presenting at Virginia Tech, now that's to graduate students and so on. I'd really like to sort of do things like that, but take it down to a high school level.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of teach people about big data and social net, you know, so the need to collaborate and social networks and open data, and get them into that mindset early before they even get to grad school, before they get corrupted by the whole publisher perish system.
Right, exactly. And for the record, the post that Chris Lasher bookmarked was a thing called Scientists Meet Small Children and Doesn't Stop Talking and Listening All Day. And it's about the...
Oh, this is the Vox one,
right?
Vox one,
the Lorena, right. And it's about the Teacher Scientist Network, and I think that's a UK-based organization. And it's quite fascinating. Wonderful. And I met the chemistry teacher there, and she hooked me up with, I guess YouTube has this show called Brainiac. It's a show that's very popular in the UK. And I spent around 2 hours yesterday watching episodes from this show, and they are incredible. They do crazy things like take like thermite plasma and throw it onto a car and see it melt away.
Yeah, I saw that. I've actually seen that.
They take
one.
Giant chunks of cesium and put them in water and show you that it explodes instantly. And it's a really exciting way to like approach, you know.
That's kind of how I learned chemistry, was like burning magnesium strips.
Yeah, I don't think they do that nowadays. I wouldn't be surprised if it's like toxic.
There's too much protection. It's difficult to get these things and so on and so forth. And we used to do crazy stuff when we were kids at home. You know, blow things up, and that was fun.
Right.
You know, making rockets and all that will probably get you into trouble now.
Yeah. You never know who will come knocking on your door.
I was watching that whole Sputnik rocket movie on the plane or something the other day. Oh, no, I think in my hotel. And, like, I wish more, you know, we need to get people more into that. Maybe the people are. I just don't see it happening. People are too engrossed in their other... There's just so many distractions now. It's hard.
Yeah.
Anyway, we've got like 3 minutes, 2 minutes left on our 35-minute podcast. Anything else you wanted to cover
there's
today?
There's definitely a very cool blog post on interest levels in scientific social tagging. Did you take
it? Yeah.
So I'm just trying to see where the data came from. But anyway, the punchline of this was they analyzed a number of unique visitors to several social tagging sites, and the ones that are on the graph here are Sites You Like, Conatia, and Bibsonomy, and and they compared that with the number of unique visitors to something like NCBI. At least attribution here says it comes from compete.com, so it's some...
Yeah, so it's Compete tracks web traffic trends.
Right, exactly. So looking at that, what they found was that the number of people on unique visitors to NCBI is typically around 2 million. And compared that with somebody on all of these sites, the average is around like 30,000. So, I guess the contrast is very, very drastic.
30,000 uniques a month or just total?
30,000 unique visitors a month, yeah.
That's very low.
Versus 2 million.
If I tried harder, I might get halfway there.
Yeah.
On BBGM.
I mean, the comments in the post were very exciting, and I think Duncan Hull said something like, actually, just a second, it was something to the point of, you know, are we kidding ourselves, or is this thing totally insignificant, you know, like the whole social tagging move?
So I've said so. I mean, I think we've talked about it before, that if But if you looked at the people tagging science and delicious,
right, exactly, and that's what
exactly you get. You get what I'm right. saying, right?
No, in fact, my comment to this blog post was, too bad they left delicious out of this, because something tells me delicious will come very close to, you know, beating the pants off the other Connetia, Cytilike, and so on.
Oh, I think if you take the number of people tagging scientific stuff on delicious, right. we'd probably beat all of the rest combined.
Right. Well, I don't know about the NCBI, but I just.
Yeah. No, not NCBI, right. because NCBI is where everyone goes,
yeah.
right? It's even people who don't do stuff on the web. So that's always going to be higher. But I think if you look at the people doing scientific tagging on delicious, you might actually start pushing NCBI, because there'll be people doing scientific tagging on delicious who don't ever go to NCBI because they're not scientists. They're casual users.
Right, exactly.
So that's I mean, I think, see, it goes back to the thing that, I think that's why Zotero is going to succeed in the end, because it's meant for professionals. It's not a casual tool, and you know, things like that. But it goes back to the whole discussion around, you know, what's the value that a lot of these sites provide? Mm-hmm. What do they do that why should I use those above delicious? If I can just keep, you know, other than maybe keeping it in a format that I can put it into EndNote.
Right.
If I want to find stuff, I can find it easily in delicious. It's right there with everything else that I do. It's one-stop resource. It's definitely something that a lot of people in this space need to consider. I think even amongst the life science sort of early adopter alpha adopter community now, there's a strong backlash against quote unquote scientific social networks,
mm-hmm.
because we are tired of seeing something come and not really add value.
Yeah,
I stopped saving stuff to Connetia.
It takes like three minutes.
Yeah,
3 minutes for it to just, you know, look it up and look up the DOI and come back. And in 3 minutes, I've already probably, you know, got as much value out of that particular article I was reading as I would want to.
Yeah,
and that's just too long. And Delicious, I mean, the network that Delicious has is so extensive that after Google, I search on Delicious. I mean, it really, for science, for technology, for everything, it's an incredible resource. And
yeah, we've talked about it before. I think all Delicious needs, honestly, is a plugin that can resolve DOIs.
Right,
and you're pretty much good to
go. Right, exactly. And I think, I'm sure, I mean, hopefully that'll come soon. Hey, I had a question for you, actually, and this is kind of unrelated to... So Duncan had this really good quote that I'm trying to find on FrenFeed. But how does one search this thing? I mean, you...
FrenFeed?
Yeah,
it's a search box
up
there.
Yeah, I know, but it's just...
But it doesn't search everything.
Yeah, it doesn't search everything, and it just seems
It searches people you're connected to.
Yeah, okay, well... We'll maybe cover that some other day. But for those of you who are on FrenFeed, check out Duncan Hull's comment on this post, which basically tells us that we are pitifully inadequate in assuming that things like Connetia, Cytilike, etc. will get even close to being as important as NCBI.
And they should. And why should they?
Well, why should they? That's true.
Yeah. On the other hand, I think NCBI could do a lot on its end.
I think the NCBI, it's a very sad thing. They've done a lot. Like, NCBI collections, I think, is exactly...
Oh, no, I agree. They've done a lot
right.
of...
And they're improving day by... I mean, they're really... I think they've finally
it's
got
a
it.
It's a lot of the UI work needs to be improved.
I think even that, there's been a lot of improvements lately. Like, you know, they started showing related searches, and that's so useful. And they...
But if you look at, but if you do like a Go, like a PubMed search in some of these alternative PubMed sources, you really realize some of the things that NCBI is missing in terms of just, it's their URIs, for example, are so useless.
Uh-huh.
They really need to do something about their endpoints, for example. Like, you know, you can't do a RESTful URI search on NCBI unless maybe they change that. Historically, you couldn't.
Oh, no, there's quite a lot of RESTful, like PMIDs and stuff. You can rest.
Yeah, maybe they've changed. Yeah, maybe they've changed that. Yeah, I mean, I definitely see that they've added features over the last, you know, it's been a while since I regularly searched NCBI. Maybe I need to go back and look. But they started making changes, and I really think that PubMed has the possibility to be your main resource.
Right.
You know, and if they do a few things, they can completely obliterate all these other things, because, you know, at least as life scientists, that's where we go. I mean, there's lots of other science outside of life science where, you know, even for molecular dynamics, finding papers on PubMed can get hard because they're published in things like the Journal of Chemical Physics.
Right, exactly. No, I think anyway. You actually said it very well earlier on, is that the innovation is obviously happening amongst all these other, you know, kind of front-end developers, like the other sites, right? I use only PubMed, but I'm glad PubMed's the way it is. And I wouldn't really want it to change too much, because if you're an expert user, like if you use all those tags and so on, it's so easy to find things on PubMed. Like I would hate for them to have like things like Flash and other things.
No, they don't need Flash. I'm just saying, just need good they need just good JavaScript tools.
Yeah, and they've started having, I mean, there's so much like JavaScript on there now. And all right, maybe next week, you know, the RESTful thing.
Maybe we should have a long dedicated to PubMed and search in the science.
I will have my, like we'll have an episode titled Why I Think PubMed Should Not Change. And it's really, really awesome.
and I'm sure I'll have a lot of counters to that. So let's call it a day. We've been at it for 40 minutes. So your car is already idling for a while.
Well, it's probably going to be snowing by the time, you know. So that's 40 minutes is about right.
Yeah. Alrighty, folks. Deepak signing off. And
this is Hari signing off. And this was episode 4 of...
Number 4. And we shall call it the Galaxy Zoo episode or something like that. I don't know. Alrighty.
We should call it a supercomputing meets galaxies. And in the molecular dynamics
effect. Never mind. Talk to you next week. Cheers. Bye-bye.